work on a project to create the next version of the ELR implementation guide. And so my presentation is applying the lessons learned from ELR 2.3.x. We're working on a version for 2.5.1. And first, a little bit about myself. I'm a HL7 messaging specialist. I'm a contractor, SAIC consultant to the CDC. I'm a member of the Finn messaging team. And I'm heavily involved in HL7, co-chair of the laboratory work group, and member of the technical steering committee. And the co-author of this presentation, Rita Altimore, who is heavily involved with the National ELR Group and works for the Washington State Department of Health. She isn't here this week, and sadly, sorely missed by a lot of us. And I have to provide this disclaimer that the CDC wants on all these presentations. And the agenda for my talk today is to go over an ELR history and timeline of the various ELR versions of the implementation guide that have been out there over the years, and then kind of review the important lessons learned from ELR implementations. There have been a lot of those. Then give you an overview of the ELR 2.5.1 project that we've been working on, and then give an overview of the high points of the 2.5.1 ELR implementation guide, and then really the last part is to launch a discussion of where we want to take that implementation guide. Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, ELR Wars. First, there was ELR 2.3z, and we had a lot of implementers who wanted to do electronic laboratory reporting, and there were a lot of ways of doing it. That's one of the nice things about HL7 is there's a lot of ways to do it. And so we had 2.3z, and that fairly rapidly evolved into 2.3.1 ELR. And then there were many versions of ELR 2.3.1. There was ELR for microbiology. There was ELR for bioterrorism. There were updates to the original ELR guide. And then there was a 2.5 draft, and now we have a 2.5.1 draft. And there are probably other versions that I've never heard of, too. Some of the important lessons that we've learned from ELR, and actually this list is sadly lacking stuff. One of the things I wanted to do but never got around to doing was polling people on what all the lessons to be learned were. Some of the ones that we came up with were reduce or eliminate optionality and make implementation simpler, retain backwards compatibility where possible, and avoid dramatic changes which will cause the labs and vendors to ignore the implementation guide. You might say the entire implementation guide that we've produced is a summation of all our lessons learned. And it's not just ELR lessons learned, but it's ones we've learned from FLIP and LIMS-I and HL7 itself. The ELR 2.5.1 project, some of the background, we didn't actually start with the old 2.3.1 ELR guide. Instead, we started with the 2.5.1 interoperable lab result to EHR implementation guide that was developed by HL7 for the use of HITSPE. And interestingly enough, that particular guide had its genesis with the 2.5 draft that was produced on that list you saw. So there is some continuity going back to ELR with that, but it's been through a very different process than some of the other implementation guides we've seen. What we did do with the HL7 guide is we aligned it and extended it with the existing 2.3.1 ELR implementation guides. We had to pre-adopt some stuff, or not pre-adopt, but adopt some stuff that HITSPE had decided to constrain out. So we had to relax some things as well as constraining some things. And then we've had cross-fertilization or cross-pollination with the FLIP and LIMS integration projects. We've also been working with the FIND vocabulary community of practice and the ELR community of practice in developing this implementation guide. The team, The project leaders were Steve Steindl, myself, and Rita Altimore, and we had a host of participants, CSTE National ELR group members, CDC folks, APHL FLIP team, LIMS-I team, commercial lab partners, LIMS vendors. I have a huge email list that I try to maintain of all the people who've been invited, and a large, significant number of those people have been participating on our conference calls. So, we built this on 251. Yes?
One other standard that's floating out around there has been the California Healthcare Foundation
E-Links. Yes. Oh yes, I've looked at that, and how to say this? That actually gets into politics that I really didn't want to get involved in, quite frankly. Yes, in that it represents the position of certain laboratories. And for that reason, probably shouldn't be ignored, but this project basically did. So why move to HL7251 to ELR? The answer is simple. Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. Actually, the answer is anything but simple. There have been a lot of changes to the HL standard, HL7 standard between 231 and 251. There have been new messages that have been added, new segments have been added, segments have been added to old messages have been retired, new fields have been added to old segments, new data types have been added, old data types have been retired, clarifications have been added all over the place. So there's been a lot of change over the past few years since 231. Where do all these changes come from? Well, you guys and all the interfacing community out there. So why should you care about these changes? Although HL7 is an international standard, the U.S. provides the majority of members and drives the majority of change requests to HL7 2.x. Many organizations here in the U.S. want to move to new 2.x versions so they can use the new features they have pushed into the standard. On the other hand, there are many organizations who do not want to change because change is costly and time-consuming. So we have these tensions. We have those who want to change and those who don't. And sometimes they're the same organizations. So we have an organization called HITSPE. And they're playing a role in this whole thing. HITSPE is a public-private collaborative to induce change in healthcare messaging. And its job is to select standards to be used to promote interoperability in the U.S. healthcare system. HITSPE also identifies where standards are missing. So, the U.S. healthcare market. HITSPE is just the tip of the iceberg. And HITSPE in the changing U.S. healthcare market, the growing emphasis on HITSPE and organizations desiring interoperability is evidence that we're approaching or have already passed the tipping point. I think that was already mentioned in the plenary yesterday. This is happening because market forces are pushing everyone towards newer versions of HL7. So icebergs tip over. That's my analogy here. So late adopters HITSPE will become the majority of vendors will have adopted that in the U.S. healthcare market will be using that, and late adopters will be the tip of the iceberg that's out there. Tipping point, like iceberg tipping over seeking equilibrium, the pressure of the U.S. healthcare industry to change will overcome resistance to change. You can prepare for these changes or ignore them, and late adopters will be left behind as changes accelerate. So be prepared to change. Okay, our ELR 251 development process. The ELRIG was developed as an HL7 message profile, and there's actually a section in the HL7 standard that describes what goes into a profile. The initial guide, as I indicated before, was we started it from the HITSPE HL7 EHR IG, LabDAT EHR IG, which is based on 251. And then we sat down in a corner and applied our best guess as to what else we needed to toss in there. A lot of that came from what was already supported in the 231 ELR IG. So that involved adding things like the NK1 segment back in. HITS bid constrained it out because the ambulatory lab market wasn't particularly interested in it and didn't see the need. Well, that's important for some types of ELR reporting. We've ended up pre-adopting some material from 2.6, and actually we've pre-adopted from 2.7 as well, where we needed to. HITSBI guide actually started that, so we just continued doing a little of it. Primarily that happens when we're dealing with vocabulary. Some of the latest vocabulary we've gone ahead and pre-adopted where we believe it's useful. We decided not to just jump onto 2.6, primarily because CSTA put out a mandate to move to 2.5 and not 2.6. Earlier this year, back in January, we took that draft ELR guide and reviewed it with a small group of public health related people at HL7, primarily some members of the Public Health and Emergency Response Work Group. During that time, we decided to conduct a set of review conference calls of the draft ELRIG with a joint CSTE, CDC, and APHL group. Primarily, it's the national ELR group. Over the course of about 20 some odd conference calls, over the course of 6 months, we reviewed in sometimes excruciating detail the implementation guide. The pace of that review picked up in July, we started meeting for two-hour conference calls during the week. Deadlines of getting the guide done by this conference prompted that accelerated pace, and we still had significant participation throughout the entire process. So I want to thank the people who hung along with us and plotted all the way through with us. These reviews are one of the primary mechanisms by which the various lessons learned the participants brought forward, how they've been incorporated into the IG, and that's one of the reasons why I say the IG itself is the summation of all our lessons learned at this point. Late last week, I got the final draft version posted out on our out on Sitescape. We were using the ELR Community of Practice website out on Sitescape, and so it's final draft version only in the sense it was the final version I'm producing for the FIN conference. It's not complete. There's still issues with it, and we still have to discuss where we're taking it. I'm going to go over some of the high points of the implementation guide. It is virtually identical to the HITSBI HL7 guide. We really didn't change much. It has an introduction, a messaging infrastructure section, message profile section, section that goes into the message structures, and then the obligatory segment and field description sections, which consume the bulk of the document. And then there's a section on coding systems and value sets. There's an example message section. And then there are a couple of appendices, one for reporting of culture and susceptibilities, and another for CLIA, Clinical Laboratory Improvement of Benefit Considerations. The introduction to the guide defines the purpose. Specification for laboratory results reporting to local, state, and territorial and federal public health agencies, addresses the messaging content and dynamics related to transmission of ELR, and each state and territory will have its own requirements for laboratories to report certain findings to public health. The guide does not get into the specifics of reporting specific diseases or conditions. From that perspective, it's generic. In theory, you should be able to handle just about any sort of reportable condition. So we don't make any attempt to define what those reportable conditions are. We're just saying how you would report them in a message. And it's intended to meet the needs and requirements of implementation guidance in public health entities, replacing the previous version, ELR 231. It does not replace the need for documentation of the constraints for a specific implementation. So each individual state may end up having to create one or more specific implementation guides for their state-specific requirements. And the guide is not intended to replace having access to the 251HL7 standard itself. So we're not regurgitating the entire 251 standard. So you need to have access to that. As I've said before, it's the exchange of laboratory results from testing source to the appropriate public health agencies. It focuses on a couple of key points of broad interoperability, including the use of strong identifiers for key information objects and the use of vocabulary standards. And it does not cover environmental lab reporting or result reporting to cancer registries. It does cover reporting of laboratory results for individual humans and animals. The messaging infrastructure section there's a messaging framework section that includes discussions about the message delimiters to be used, null values, links, and snapshot processing. We also discuss the use of escape sequences in the message, and then there's an extensive section that describes the various data types that are used throughout the various segments that are supported in the message, and it gives that's another one of the excruciating details that we went through during the review. There's a section that describes the message profile. It has a use case model, which describes a description of the use case, the actors involved, any assumptions and business rules that are associated with the use case. There's a dynamic interaction model that's documented using UML. Then there's a dynamic definition, which documents the details needed for an HL7 message profile, including a profile ID, HL7 version, acknowledgement details, type of profile, et cetera. And then finally, there's a section on interactions, which defines the supported interactions that include trigger events, message types, receiver actions, important data values, and usage requirements. The messages chapter defines the structure of the two messages that are described in the specification. One is our old friend, the ORU R01 message, which is your unsolicited observation message. Carries the actual results. There also describes the optional acknowledgement message. This is one of the variances from HITSPE, where HITSPE had made use of the acknowledgement mandatory. In the public health space, where we're doing a lot of batch processing, the acknowledgements kind of become unnecessary. But it's left in there as a optional component of it. Describes the message structure and the constraints that we've applied to those message structures. And there's an example of it, of the style of documentation. In the left column, we describe essentially describes the structure of the message as defined in the HL7 standard. So we don't really change what's in this first column. That's what the standard provides. What we do is apply constraints in the usage column and the cardinality column, which are potentially constraints on what HL7 says. So we can tighten things up and say, where HL7 says something is optional, we can say it's required. Or they say you can have many of them, we can say, well, we're only going to allow one of those. So those are the types of constraints we're applying. What we're not doing is relaxing HL7. We're sticking within the rules laid down by HL7. Then we have a section that has the segment and field descriptions. And like I said, this is actually the bulk of the document. It has these various segment attribute tables, which describe the essentially all the fields and all the segments, and this is the laundry list of segments that we've supported. MSH, SFT, MSA, ERR, PID, NK1, PB1, PB2, ORC, OBR, OBX, SPM, and NTE segments. And all the fields and all those segments that we are supporting, we describe. The segment tables provide information about the constraints that we've applied within the segments, and those constraints again include usage, cardinality, the value sets, the vocabulary that we're talking about, and we, in most many cases, we provide additional description or comments. And this is an example of one of the segment tables. In this case, it's the OBX, and so very much like the message, we stick with the HL7 structure and apply constraints to that. So we don't take required fields and loosen the constraints on it from HL7. We will take and tighten it down, and there, one of the interesting problems we run into is the tension between wanting to tighten things down to make them to reduce optionality and yet support everybody's requirements, which pull in the other direction to loosen things up. One of the great cross-pollination things that happened with this is we were able to leverage some work that was going on in the LIMS-I integration project and came up with a table of observation identifiers, observation values, interpretations, and comments that provide guidance on values to report in OBX5 based upon the observation identifiers. We do this by looking at the LOINC scale property and associating with that scale property the appropriate data type to be used. And this is taking the level of specification to another, it's taking it to another level here of specificity. That wasn't there previously, and it was rather obvious from some of the samples that we were getting as part of the review that this level of specificity, some people weren't even aware that they should be looking at that level. So this will provide another level of uniformity that will make processing of these things simpler, but it's one of the harder things that the labs are probably going to find harder to implement. The coding system and value set section, it includes a brief discussion of code system versus value set. We describe the constraints that are applied to a number of the external coding systems, such as LOINC, SNOMED, UCM, UBO4, HL7 table 396, and some of the FLIP coding systems and value sets. The final chapters in the guide have example ELR messages. I know there were people who were pushing for a lot more examples, but we ran out of time getting examples in there. So that's another place where we're going to be adding more stuff down the road, probably. The two appendices, HL7 reporting of culture and susceptibilities, and the CLIA improvement appendices, those are essentially verbatim from the HL7 guide. Essentially unchanged at this point. Next, how to use this implementation guide. The EOR IG is an HL7 constrainable message profile. That means it still has optional things in it. And that means that there's still work to be done. And it's not at this level, there's still work to be done at this level, but each individual implementation, whether that be at a state level, a local public health, whoever's going to be doing implementations, needs to further constrain this to meet their local requirements. Because ultimately, the goal is implementers will want to have a fully constrained implementation profile that has nothing optional left. And that's the ultimate goal, is to have an implementation guide for your specific implementation that doesn't have anything optional left. All we're trying to do at this level is reduce how much negotiation that has to go on. We can't eliminate it, There's still going to be things you're going to have to negotiate, but we're trying to reduce it. So, one of the big questions we have left outstanding for this implementation guide is what's our final approval process going to look like? There are a number of people in the group who are pushing to take this to HL7 and ballot it. There are some people who really don't want to do that. Among other things, tomorrow night at the National ELR group, we're going to discuss this. And so if you have an interest in the answer to that question, I heartily recommend you show up for that National ELR group meeting from 5 to 7 tomorrow night. And one question, is this the last ELR IG? Well, if history has anything to say about it, no, it's not the last one. We're never going to have a last one. Yes, history teaches us that revisions to this implementation guide are inevitable. There are errors, and they already know there are. And there's always going to be new requirements that you got to accommodate. And there's plenty of new things out there on the horizon already. You know, the HL7 is already working on, it's balloting 2.7 right now, and there's already proposals in the pipeline for 2.8. And then there's also HL7 version 3 and clinical document architecture potential implementation. So there's a lot of fertile area where work could be done if there's any interest. Another question that we need to get ironed out is a change control process for this. We don't have one right now. We have me. That's not a good, reliable change control process. If the ELR IG goes through HL7, then that's actually a way of managing the change control. It's not necessarily the greatest way to do it, but it is a way to do it. If it doesn't go that route, then we need to create a process for that. And we have some examples. LIMS-I has it. FLIP has change control processes. So there are a variety of ways we can go with that. Maintenance and distribution, that's to a large extent, that's going to be dictated by some of the other decisions we make. But if we go our own way, we got to figure out how to do all that. So in the end, well, I want to thank everybody who participated. This was definitely a group effort. We want to thank all the people who made an effort to join the conference calls and provide feedback on the guide. And our special thanks to Ricky Merrick, who, without any prompting, took on the task of taking notes for most of our conference calls. And I did leave about 5 minutes for questions. And I don't, yes. Well, it's there's going to be a tremendous overlap. And we're both using the same message for the same, well, we may actually end up using different messages. Yeah, they haven't quite decided which message they're going to be using, but as soon as you get down below the message level, you're dealing with the same segments and the same fields. And from that perspective, I expect something on the orders 95% overlap. And when you get down to the real details, the important thing is we're using the same vocabularies, blanket SNOMED, and some of these things we can't dictate at the same level that, say, FLIP or a LIMS-I can, but in ELR, we have a very different audience implementers who are actually going to be sending this that we can't actually dictate to. So, We can't dictate at the same level that some of these other projects can, but we can certainly leverage off of the work they've done, and we've been doing that.